Before we begin this episode, let's hear from our sponsor, Anchor.
Now, back to our show.
Before I start, a notice of discretion. Today's stories are real, gruesome, and explicit. Please be aware that I will be discussing crimes related to rape, murder, pedophilia, and other violent acts. In no way does Ramblings and Remedies support any type of violent acts or crimes. This episode is meant purely for informational purposes. Thank you. Lee Chun-jae, aka the Korean Zodiac Killer. Responsible for at least 14 known murders and raped at least 30 women during the period of 1986 to 1994, he is the inspiration for movies Memories of Murder and Confession of Murder and many other films and shows. Not much is known about the early life of Lee Chun-jae. He was born in Hwaseong City on January 31, 1963. Hwaseong City is located in Gyeonggi Province of South Korea. He lived in Hwaseong City for about 30 years. He had a sister who drowned for unknown reasons, and he was supposedly very much affected by this. He himself claimed to have been sexually assaulted by a family member, though there is no evidence of this. Lee graduated from high school in February 1983 and joined the Republic of Korea Army as a tank pilot. He was discharged in 1986, and only a few short months later, Lee began his crime spree. On September 15, 1986, his first victim was a 71-year-old woman. She was found in a field with her hands tied, gagged, and wounds on her body. He had blitz attacked her. She was raped and then strangled with his bare hands. 1 month later, a 25-year-old woman was found naked and murdered in a ditch near a rice field. Another victim was an 18-year-old woman. Lee tied her hands with the blouse, gagged her with socks, and then proceeded to rape her, and then strangled her with the scarf. On April 3, 1991, the final victim was a 69-year-old woman found in the hills with her trousers taken off. Lee targeted vulnerable females with no specific victim type. The ages ranged from 13 to 71 years of age. He continued this similar pattern of attack, rape, and murder for a possible 10 victims. These series of 10 murders came to be known as the Hwaseong Serial Murders. Though semen was found at the crime scenes, at the time, forensic technology was still too rudimentary to match DNA evidence. The police spent 2 million man days to investigate. 21,280 people were looked into as suspects, but for 33 years, police were unable to crack the murders. In between the Hwaseong serial murders, Lee committed other crimes where he was actually caught and charged with. On September 26, 1989, only a few weeks after the first Hwaseong murder, Lee broke into a house but was immediately caught by the landlord, who alerted the police. He was sentenced to 18 months in prison on the charges of robbery and violence. Lee filed an appeal stating that he entered the house for protection because an unknown assailant had been chasing him. The court suspended his sentence to 24 months of probation and was released in April 1990. He began to work at an electric parts company. Then he worked as a crane driver for a couple of years. In April 1992, he married a bookkeeper. In 1993, only a year later, his wife filed for divorce for unknown reasons. Lee wanted revenge against his wife. He invited his wife's 18-year-old sister, his sister-in-law, over to his house. He proceeded to drug, rape, and strangle her, the same method he used for his previous victims. By this time, it had been about 3 years since Lee committed his last murder. He would have gotten away with everything, but this last killing was his undoing. Lee and his father-in-law went to the police to report his sister-in-law missing. He even offered to join the search for her. But the police found his behavior suspicious, and only 5 days later, he was arrested. He may have incriminated himself when he asked during questioning, "How many years do you serve in prison for rape and murder?" Because no one had mentioned anything about rape and murder in relation to the case, this raised further suspicions. The police were able to get a full confession out of Lee, which Lee later redacted, stating that he was forced into confession. He was still sentenced by the court for rape and murder of his sister-in-law. Originally a death sentence that was later reduced to life in prison. Fast forward to 2019, the cold cases of Hwasong serial murders were still being investigated. DNA evidence was finally recovered and matched to Lee. Initially, Lee denied being the Hwasong killer. However, on October 2, 2019, he confessed to the murders. The Hwasong serial murder case highlighted the incompetence of the police and investigation. According to the statute of limitations, it stated that a person would not be held responsible for first-degree murder if legal proceedings were not initiated within 25 years. Even though this was abolished in 2015, it was not retroactively applied to the Hwasong serial murders, so Lee would not face any further prosecution. Lee also confessed to 5 additional killings, 3 in Hwasong and 2 in Cheongju. These investigations are still ongoing. And between 1986 and 1991, Lee said that he raped over 30 women, as many as 45 women. In a confusing copycat murder and impossible desperation by the police had wrongfully accused an innocent man to 20 years in prison for a murder committed by Lee. This man, Yoo Sang-yeo, was thought to have been Lee's copycat. Yoon was suspected to have murdered and raped a 14-year-old girl. A pubic hair was a partial match, and Yoon even confessed to the murder. Only after Lee confessed to the Hwasong serial murders did they realize Yoon was an innocent man. People have come to believe that Yoon was forced into confession. How was DNA not matched for over 25 years? How are these 5 additional murders not connected? How was an innocent man robbed of 20 years for crimes he never committed? Lee is currently serving life in prison. Ahmad Suraji, a self-proclaimed Indonesian sorcerer who murdered and drank the saliva of 42 girls and women for 11 years from 1986 to 1997. Ahmad Suraji's real name is Nasik Kilawang. Born on January 10, 1949, in a small Indonesian village called Aman Dami, ironically translated to peace and tranquility. He was born to a self-proclaimed sorcerer. His father had a respect from the community for resolving issues with magic. Mystic powers were widely believed throughout Indonesia. There are even sorcerers offering services in modern shopping centers. As a child, Suraji had trouble making friends and was a loner. He didn't do very well in school and turned to a life of crime. When he was only 19, he went to prison for 10 years for petty crime and public violence. After he was released, only 2 years later, he was back in prison for cattle theft. Suraji wanted to become a different person. He wanted people to admire him like his father, so he turned to sorcery. Like his father, he started helping the people in this community. He was revered and regarded as Datuk Marindi. Locals believed he could move clouds and heal the sick. Suraji had also married. He had 3 wives, who were also all his sisters. Later, one of them would become his accomplice in the murders and help hide the bodies. In 1986, Suraji had a dream. In his dream, his deceased father told him that he needed to obtain the saliva of 70 young women in order to attain invincibility and become a mystic healer. For 11 years, he continued his mission to attain invincibility. As a sorcerer or dukun, women will come to him for spiritual advice, to make themselves more beautiful or richer, or for assistance in love or marriage. He would also target prostitutes because he couldn't wait around for more women to come by. Many of the women came to him in secret, making it easier for them to disappear and in no way linking him to the murders. He murdered 42 girls and women. The ages ranged from 11 to 30 years of age. The girls and women would be taken to his sugarcane plantation. They would be buried to their waist, all the while telling them that this was a necessary part of his ritual. Then they were strangled with a cable. He would drink their saliva, unbury them, then undress them so they can decompose faster. Then he would rebury them with the heads of the victim facing his house. On April 27, 1997, a farmer was taking his cattle to feed near the sugarcane plantation. He came across an unusual mound of dirt. He alerted the village head and at the time, Suraji's neighbor, Sugito. Sugito and a group of men went to investigate. they stuck a piece of wood into the mound and was met with a stench of decay. Sugito alerted the military, who told him to dig and see what he finds. After digging for a couple of hours, the men found a naked and bloated body of a young woman. She was recognized by the bystanders as 21-year-old Sri Kamala Dewey. Dewey had been missing for about 3 days, and no one knew where she had disappeared after leaving to run an errand. Soon after, a rickshaw driver, Andrea Suito, came forward. He said that Dewey asked him to take her to an undisclosed destination. Dewey had not wanted to tell the driver the exact location, but after pushing her for more info, Dewey said that she was going to Suraji's house. Sugito was shocked because on the day the body was discovered, Suraji had told him not to be alarmed about the body and not to have fear about ghosts. Suraji was even one of the men who had come to help investigate and dig up the body. On April 30, 1997, Suraji was arrested and interrogated for 4 days. In his confession, Suraji told the police about his dream, how his father told him to get the saliva from 70 women. But he stated that his father never said to kill the woman, but Suraji thought it would take too long to get the saliva, so killing the woman would be faster. He also stated that murder was an easy way to make money. He originally confessed to 16 murders, to the bodies that were superficially buried around the plantation. But upon searching his house, the police found evidence of at least 25 more. Then Suraji changed his story to murdering 42 girls and women. Forensics believed that more than 42 bodies were found in the sugarcane plantation. Suraji claimed that his murders were not sexually motivated. The village revealed that 80 females had gone missing, but there was no way to prove all the missing females were murdered by Suraji. Because magic is believed in Indonesia, there were many Indonesians who viewed his behavior with a degree of tolerance because he was a traditional sorcerer. And even though Suraji and his wife Tumini tried to deny the murders and that they had been tortured by the police to confess, the court found that Tumini had deliberately helped in the killings. Tumini was sentenced to death for assisting with murders, but was later reduced to life in prison. Suraji was sentenced to execution by a firing squad on July 19, 2008. Tsutomu Miyazaki, the Otaku Murderer. A Japanese serial killer, cannibal, child rapist, and necrophile. He abducted and murdered 4 young girls in Saitama, Tokyo, from August 1988 to June 1989. Born on August 12, 1962, Tsutomu came from a wealthy family. His father owned a newspaper company. His mother, while pregnant, had some complications. Tsutomu suffered deformities at birth. The joints in his hands were fused together and became these long, thin, gnarled-looking hands. During his childhood, Tsutomu was bullied by his classmates for his hands. A former classmate even said that his penis is no thicker than a pencil and no longer than a toothpick. Having no friends, he turned to anime and comic books. However, Tsutomu was an intelligent child, ranking top of his class. He had dreams of becoming a teacher. When he started failing high school, he lost interest in his studies and became more obsessed with his comic books and anime. His own parents and siblings started to ignore him, and the only person that showed him any interest was his grandfather. After flunking high school, Tsutomu was forced to attend a junior college in Itsukaishi, Tokyo. Here, he took a photo technician course. In college, his sexual urges began to grow. Because everything he learned about sex came from comic books and anime, he had a very warped idea about sexual relationships. He never had a real relationship and stayed away from women his own age due to lack of confidence. Once comic books and anime no longer satisfied him, he turned to child pornography. He said that Japanese pornography was boring because they blacked out most of the important parts. He would also go to tennis courts and take pictures of girls. In 1983, he graduated from college and moved back to his home. He started working at a printing plant owned by a family friend through his father's newspaper company connections. In 1988, after the passing of his grandfather, Tsutomu started to lose his hold on the real world. The only affectionate bond to another human being was gone. He now only had his pornography and violent movies. In desperation to keep his grandfather alive, Tsutomu ate some of his grandfather's cremated remains. When his sister caught him peeking at her in the bathroom, Tsutomu retaliated by attacking her. When confronted by his mother, he responded the same way. It was obvious that Tsutomu was becoming unhinged. On August 22, 1988, Tsutomu abducted 4-year-old Kono Mari. He took her to a wooded area west of Tokyo. In his parked car, they chatted for 30 minutes. Then he put his hands around her and strangled her and engaged in sexual acts with her corpse. He undressed her and left her naked body in the woods, taking her clothes with him. Over the next several weeks, he would return to the woods to check on her body. He removed her hands and feet and kept them in his closet. He then burned the rest of the body and took some of the ashes. The police spent weeks searching for Mari. Over 50,000 missing posters of Mari were passed out. The police drove around neighborhoods, warning to not let their children wander alone. On October 1988, he spotted Yoshizawa Masami walking along the road and offered her a ride home. He then strangled her like Mari and sexually assaulted the corpse, took the clothes, wrapped the body in a sheet, and put it in his trunk. He was almost caught when his tire became stuck in a gutter. In a panic, he dumped the naked body in the nearby woods. When he returned to the car, he was met with two people who had arrived to help him push his car out. Parents of little girls became terrified. The newspaper dubbed him the otaku killer or otaku murderer, and his crimes, the little girl's murder. Several months later, he took his third victim, Namba Erika. Erika was another 4-year-old girl. He drove her to the prefecture of Saitama to a parking lot. While Erika was alive, he took pictures of her. Then he strangled her, dumped her body at the parking lot, and left her clothes nearby. He sent a postcard to Erika's family. Using magazine cutouts, he wrote, "Erika, cold, throat, rest, death." On February 6, 1989, months after Mari's disappearance, and after his second and third victim, Mari's father found a box on his doorstep. In the box, Tsutomu had placed Mari's ashes, some of her teeth, and photos of her clothes with the postcard that read, "Mari, cremated, bones, investigate, proof." A few days later, on February 11th, a letter titled "Crime Confession" was sent to Mari's mother that read, "I put the cardboard box with Mari's remains in it in front of her home. I did everything, from the start of the Mari incident to the finish. I saw the police press conference where they said the remains were not Mari's. On camera, her mother said the report gave her new hope that Mari might still be alive. I knew then that I had to write this confession so Mari's mother would not continue to hope in vain. I say again, the remains are Mari's." And once the police were able to identify Mari from the ashes and teeth, Tsutomu sent the parents a confession letter. "Before I knew it, the child's corpse had gone rigid. I wanted to cross her hands over her breast, but they wouldn't budge. Pretty soon, the body gets red spots all over it. Big red spots, like the Hinomaru flag. After a while, the body is covered with stretch marks. It was so rigid before, but now it feels like it's full of water. And the smell, how it smells, like nothing you've ever smelled in this whole wide world." The last killing happened on June 1989. Tsutomu abducted 5-year-old Nomoto Ayako. He had convinced her to let him take photos of her. Then he murdered her. Unlike the three other murders, he took Ayako's body home. And for the next 2 days, he sexually assaulted the corpse, masturbated, and photographed and videoed her. Once the decomposition set in, he chopped up her body. He took the pieces of head and torso to a cemetery, a public restroom, and nearby woods. He also ate parts of her hands and drank her blood. When he feared that the police would find the body parts, he retrieved them and kept the body parts in his closet. In July 1989, he tried to abduct his fifth victim. While wandering the park, he noticed two sisters playing in their yard. He separated the younger one from the older and dragged her to his car. The older sister ran to get her father, who attacked Tsutomu while he was trying to take photos of his naked daughter in the car. Tsutomu ran away naked, but later came back to get his car, but was ambushed by the police. The police began their investigation in his apartment. They found over 5,000 videos, including tapes of him sexually assaulting corpses, photographs of victims and their clothing. They also found the decomposing body of Ayako with her hands missing. When questioned, Tsutomu was very calm. He blamed everything on his alter ego, the Rat Man, who lives inside him and forces him to do these terrible things. He even said, "I've done a good job. I am a Japanese hero, and this is my stage." He was disowned by his parents. His father committed suicide and blamed everything on Tsutomu. Tsutomu never apologized for his crimes. Experts were divided as to the mental state of Tsutomu. Some said that he had personality disorder, but that he was fully aware of what he was doing. Others said that he had a feeble mind and that his mind was not working properly during the killing spree. He was sentenced to death by hanging on June 17, 2008. And so this wraps up my mini-series on supernatural and murders. Thank you for allowing me to explore this obsession of mine. I definitely had a lot of fun, and I hope you guys did as well. I do have a lot of ideas that I want to explore about this topic, so maybe in the future I will come back to it. Before I wrap up this episode, I do have some updates. Sabina, my also reluctant partner in crime, is returning. We have new content being prepared. The last several weeks were more fun and rambling content, so we do want to start giving you guys a little more serious and thought-provoking episodes. We will be taking a break for the rest of February, but will return at the beginning of March. Moving forward, new episodes will be released every 2 weeks to maintain quality and high standard content and editing. Only the best for you guys. Thank you for all the support and understanding. And make sure to subscribe to wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And never forget, there are friends, there is family, and there is us. Until next time, bye!